Good morning, everyone. My name is Margaret Nowicki from DPI. Welcome to the presentation of the Millennium Development Goals Gap Task Force Report 2014. Entitled The State of the Global Partnership for Development, the MDG Gap Task Force Report tracks delivery on commitments listed under Millennium Development Goal 8, which is the Global Partnership for Development. Goal 8 was created as a call to developed countries to extend specific types of support to developing countries to help them achieve the other seven MDGs. I'm joined this morning by Mr. Wu Hongbo, Undersecretary General of the UN Department of Economic and Social Affairs. On my far left, Mr. Thomas Gass, Assistant Secretary General for Policy Coordination and Interagency Affairs in the UN Department of Economic and Social Affairs, and Mr. Magdi Martinez Soliman, to my immediate left, Deputy Assistant Administrator at the United Nations Development Program. Mr. Wu will provide opening remarks, and then the panel will take questions after as time allows. I would now like to turn it over to Mr. Wu. Sir, you have the floor.
Thank you very much. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm very pleased to launch the 2014 MDG Gap Task Force report entitled The State of the Global Partnership for Development. This year's report has a special significance. The Secretary General of the United Nations, Mr. Ban Ki-moon, has said, as I quote, "Now more than ever, leaders and citizens across the globe must boldly step forward to join in essential collective actions to eradicate poverty, raise living standards, and protect the environment. As the deadline of achieving the Millennium Development Goals, MDGs, approaches, and the member states are preparing to launch a new development agenda, it is very important to look back at what we have learned from pursuing the MDG 8 to develop a global partnership for development. But first, let us not forget that our present task, as defined by MDG 8, has not been fully achieved. The global partnership for development is strong, but much unfinished business remains. After two consecutive years of falling volumes, official ODA, that is the official development assistance, rose to reach its highest level in 2013. Despite this progress, we are still far behind our target. Shortfalls in development cooperation highlight the need for a revitalized global partnership for development as the international community moves forward, delivering a post-2015 development agenda. Multilateral trade negotiations achieved a breakthrough in December of 2013 in Bali, giving hope to an eventual conclusion of the Doha round. However, in July, the WTO reported that the agreement was not reached on the adoption of the protocol of a trade facilitation amendment. However, I'm still hopeful that they recognize the importance of this amendment will help to bridge the existing differences among member states so that they will be able to achieve an early agreement. The Bali package also included one agreement specific to LDCs, the expansion of coverage of duty-free and quota-free access to LDCs to the market of the developed countries. The original agreement was made in 2005, a WTO Hong Kong ministerial declaration. The target was set for 97% of LDC exports to benefit from a duty-free and a quota-free access to developed country markets. According to the latest data available by 2012, 85% of the LDC exports, of course excluding arms and oil, to developed country markets are duty-free or quota-free. We hope that the Bali Agreement can further increase this proportion. Debt relief program for highly indebted poor countries are coming to a conclusion. Under the HIPC, namely Heavily Indebted Poor Countries Initiative, 35 of 39 eligible countries have reached the completion point as of March 2014. As a result of the progress in HIPC initiative, debt service burdens of the poor countries have been reduced substantially to 1.6% to GDP. And in turn, the government's spending on poverty reduction in these countries has increased considerably to 10% of the GDP. The difference between these two ratios are now at the highest level in history. However, some countries, particularly a group of small states, are at the risk of debt distress. In addition, sovereign debt restructuring of other developing countries is costly and time-consuming. Global action and awareness has enhanced access to affordable essential medicines. However, the stock of medicines in developing countries remains insufficient and unaffordable for many. Developing countries have more access to some new technologies, especially information and communication technologies. However, large gaps still remain in access to many other new technologies. Take the broadband internet, for example, the high cost of which has pushed back many developing countries. Several lessons can be drawn from monitoring MDG Goal 8. First, there's a need to strengthen the linkages between MDG Goal 8 and other MDG goals. Concrete progress on Goal 8 is key to achieving progress on other MDG goals at the global level. We should also bear this in mind when we design the post-2015 development agenda. Means of implementation should go hand in hand with the goals and targets set forth for the new global development agenda. Second, global monitoring of the partnership initiatives is an essential task. It is, however, a difficult challenge. global oversight should seek to identify the gaps and advocate concrete steps so as to enhance the effectiveness of diverse cooperation partners. Third, the successor to MDG-8 should periodically be reviewed for continued relevance. We need a renewed and robust global monitoring system for measuring our progress and the gaps in implementing post-2015 development agenda. We should also remember that efforts to attain the MDGs should not be confused with the broader, long-standing international commitment to foster sustainable development. The work ahead for the international community has been laid out. Let us try our utmost to catch the remaining gaps for MDGs and prepare ourselves to a new global development agenda post-2015, which should build on the MDGs. With only 1 year ahead of us, we definitely need the strong sense of urgency and actions. Let us also seize this opportunity to stand by our promise and be in a better position to deliver on a more ambitious renewed global partnership for the new global development agenda. So our commitment to eradicate poverty, raise living standards, and sustain the environment will be truly achieved. Let us all work together, governments, international institutions, all citizens of the globe, to commit to concrete accelerated actions in achieving all MDG goals, as well as renewed global development cooperation to underpin our development efforts so that we can usher in a more sustainable future. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Undersecretary General Wu. Now, I understand that you have to leave us for another important engagement, and I would like to thank you very much for your remarks, sir. Thank you. I would like to invite Mr. Pingfan Hong, Director of Development Policy and Analysis Division of the Department of Economic and Social Affairs, to join us. Thank you. And now I would like to call on Mr. Gass for a few comments. Mr. Gass, you have the floor.
Thank you very much, and good morning to you all. It's a pleasure to be here, especially to be able to be part of the launching of such an important report. It's one thing to establish important and ambitious goals. The other thing is, of course, to measure how we are doing in terms of putting in place the means of implementing those goals. And that is the role of this MDG 8 report that has been published every year and that is being produced with the support of a whole task force and the excellent and very much appreciated cooperation of UNDP. We hope that this basis, which will be a stepping stone for a strong accountability system and a strong monitoring and review system for whatever the means of implementations are that will be set, that will be agreed upon in terms of the post-2015 agenda. I don't want to go through the facts. I think Mr. Wu outlined those facts. I'd like to actually end it there and be available for questions if there are any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Gass. And I'd now like to call on Mr. Martinez. Sorry, you have the floor.
May I? Thank you very much, Margaret. And the Assistant Secretary General, Thomas Guss, did, I'll keep my remarks very, very short to allow maximum time for interaction, questions and answers. The three or four main elements and findings of this report is, one, the importance of the so-called unfinished business that has to be and will be the core of the next agenda, be it on gender equality, on climate action, or on the reduction or eradication of extreme poverty. This is a legacy where efforts have been made, successes have been earned, but there is still a journey ahead. The importance of fair trade to development, which was, again, mentioned by Undersecretary General, who very clearly... Equally, the importance of the HIPIC agreements, which we can say have accomplished their mission, even if today new concerns have appeared on the stage of the fragmentation of debt negotiation with sovereign countries, and what we knew, the importance of medicine stocks and intellectual property rights connected to pharmaceutical products. So... a good report that takes stock of progress, that is not complacent, that evidences the difficulties that are still ahead, and that I find personally very helpful for the discussions, especially for the discussions that we will have in the road to Addis and the third International Conference on Financing for Development. With that, Margaret, over to you.
Thank you very much. Okay, we will now take your questions. Please state your name and your affiliation. Yes, please.
Hello.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Sorry.
Forgive me. Sorry. Yes.
Hi. Good morning. On behalf of the United Nations Correspondents Association, we'd like to thank you very much for holding this briefing at this very busy time. We've had so many briefings, and my name is Shauna McGee. I just had a quick question. Earlier, you had mentioned that 35 out of 39 HPI countries had reached completion by March 2014. Could you tell us a little bit more about those four countries and what remains to be done to reach that completion? Thank you so much.
Thank you. Who would like to take that question?
I mean, I think we... and. Mr. Ping Fan Hong, Director of Development Policy and Analysis Division, has also joined us here. He's one of the analysts and with his team who have worked on this report, and I hope he can also help. Whereas this ratio of those countries that have made it to those that the few that are still remaining to reach the completion point, whereas that ratio is significant, and of course for those four countries that still have to complete it. It's very important to see the bigger picture and how risky it is and how easy it is actually for countries to fall back and to slide back into an indebtedness. And especially a number of countries, as Mr. Wu also mentioned, are in very vulnerable situations for... mainly natural reasons. I mean, we're speaking mainly of the SIDS, for example, the small island development states that have had to endure and have to endure natural disasters at a frequency and at a scale also that is not comparable with the other countries. But generally, the management of the indebtedness going forward is an absolutely key factor. Now, maybe if you agree, yes, Magdi, we can ask Ping Fang to give some details on those four countries.
Yes, thank you. The remaining four countries are Chad, which is in an interim position, meaning already receiving temporary debt relief. And the other three... on the table, page 40 in the report, you can find it, Eritrea, Somalia, and Sudan. Those three have not started because we know that there are four conditions for a poor country to be eligible for the HIPIC program. One of that is very important, that is the countries should be able to come up with a set of policies which define how exactly you could use the money you saved from debt relief to reduce poverty. So without those policies, those three countries are not in the stage even to start the process. Yeah.
Thank you. Yes, please. Excuse me.
Hi, thank you. I'm Brendan Pastor. I write for South-South News. I wanted to ask about the certain trade agreements that are actually recently passed and also the ones under consideration today. It appears that more and more agreements are happening outside of the UN system, directly outside of the UN's direct monitoring control. And obviously, while they may fall in line with MDG-8's core goals and ideas, in some cases that they seem to be behind closed doors or lacking a human rights focus or any democratic mechanisms that ensure that they're equitable for all people. First of all, I'd like to ask then if what you think of the Bali package, if you believe that this was a good start for helping facilitate better trade arrangements for developing countries, but also what you think about the ongoing discussions behind closed doors of the TPP and the TTIP for between Asian countries and the U.S. and then the U.S. and European countries. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll happily take it. Let me take the first part of your question. We certainly welcome transparent, open, and properly monitored trade agreements. There's no question about that. As normative organizations, our colleagues in the trade part of the UN, the Geneva-based organizations are very much concerned when a sector of activity, for whatever reasons, does not fall within monitoring agreed monitoring mechanism. Second, we tend to see the glass half full with the Bali package. As you are aware, it had cost us quite some time to arrive at agreements, and even if minimal, they set the right direction of travel. We thought that the facilitation agreement is especially important, and especially important for developing countries. So from the perspective of UNDP, I would certainly tend to be favorable to a benign consideration and a positive evaluation of that package.
Thank you. Any other comments, gentlemen?
Maybe just to add that these other trade agreements that are done between regions or between larger countries and regions, the issue with them is not that they are behind closed doors because the countries that are involved in the negotiations are involved. The issue is that there is not the same equilibrium that you would find within a WTO negotiation where you just have more members and more larger members, and there tends to be a better balance of interests, and the interests of individual states can perhaps rise to the table a little more effectively. I don't know. Maybe Mr. Hong wants to add something to this. Also.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, what MacDee and Thomas already said. But of course, when you say beyond the UN system, or actually you mean beyond the WTO's multilateral system. We understand that, and the two largest regional trade agreement, the Trans-Pacific and the Trans-Atlantic, which are undergoing. There are positive side of that as well as a negative side of it. I think the from a developing country point of view, first of all, those are the, we know that those two largest trade agreement are initiated mainly by major developed countries, the Pacific by United States, and Transatlantic by U.S. and EU. So most developing countries are excluded from these two trade negotiations, first of all. And second, even a few, they are included in Trans-Pacific. I think they are not the leading party, so they are mainly the following. So it's very important to emphasize that the multilateral trading system at the WTO probably is the most representative and most beneficial to developing countries, not those the the regional trade agreement, particularly those large ones. They want to impose much, much higher standard, much higher than what they could actually discuss in the WTO, like the agreement on labor standard, agreement on environmental protection. Yeah, those are very important in the longer run, but in the short run, probably developing countries are not ready. So the cost for developing countries they are facing, I think, are pretty high. So let me stop here.
Could you introduce yourself, please?
Carla Stay, Global Research. I have a question and a follow-up question, and these actually are related to earlier questions I had asked. It says the lives of millions of people worldwide have improved due to concerted efforts, and I wanted to ask how that stacks up against the kind of forecast of growth and inequality that the French economist Thomas Piketty has very, very seriously put in front of the world community. And secondly, the debt relief for the world's poorest countries has increased, which of course is good, but this again is a question that I asked to Foreign Minister Timmermans when he was talking about the sovereign debt restructuring. As Nobel laureate Joseph Stiglitz said several years ago here, and he said it repeatedly, the amount of capital exported from the developing world to the developing world to the developed world is much greater than investment from the developed world into the developing world. And so this debt, which has been the interest on which has caused the developing world to borrow from the IMF and then to borrow more to pay interest on the interest, it would appear logically that in the end the developed world owes money to the developing world. So this debt, which by now Argentina is the most extreme example of this being crippling, seems to be completely irrational. So what actually is being done to improve the independence and autonomy of developing countries?
Thank you. Mr. Gauss.
I mean, I see there's a relatively broad question. From the point of the MDG 8, of course, one of its weaknesses, and I think that is agreed by all, is that it wasn't extremely specific, didn't cover many of the areas that were actually or that are relevant to advancing the fight against poverty at the global level. And so the MDG 8 report doesn't respond to all the questions that you have. However, we are concerned that the projections of spending of developed countries in development cooperation, those projections are rather low. I mean, there is some increase there, but there's not the kind of increase that would allow us to assume that we would reach the 0.7 mark across the board, or even be able to meet some of the very important challenges ahead of us, or to be able to implement the SDGs if they are agreed in any way or form as they have been discussed up to this point. Hence the importance of moving forward a much broader view and a much more detailed view on what needs to be done. And the Intergovernmental Committee of Experts on Sustainable Development Financing touched on many more of these aspects. And on that, for example, pointed to the fact that we need a debt resolution system, a sovereign debt resolution system that is more participative and more coherent.
Just to add a couple of sentences to your first remark, which is indeed broad, but I think fundamental. We always say, and this document is no exception, that yes, lives have improved, poverty has been reduced, but gains are fragile. And I think we need to be aware of the fact that when somebody attains the level of $1.25 per day or $1.40 per day, statistically you escape from the definition and the count of poverty. But in real terms, in real life, you are still somebody very, very vulnerable. You and your family are exposed to shocks. Any setback puts you back into the statistics of poverty, etc. The second consideration is that, indeed, we're all very very interested in Piketty's summary, which is at the end that the inequality gap is widening, and that is probably very well followed by the member states' discussions around adding an inequality reduction, very important vector, to the poverty eradication consideration. So it's going in the two directions. It's saying, yes, we need to continue focusing on the poorest of the poor, but at the same time, let's keep an eye on our societies when the inequality gap widens and the haves and the have-nots suddenly are completely set apart, and that gap is growing. And finally, I think that there is an interesting scholarly literature on the historic debt and on the reinvestment of capital from the poor countries towards the developed world. I think we need to maintain, therefore, the necessity of a successor goal to this one that we are discussing today, precisely to correct the imbalances, to reverse them, even if it were in a small proportion, and to maintain that the north-south flow is a very important part of development cooperation of the future.
Thank you. Mr. Hong.
I just wanted to provide a technical notes to your question regarding capital flows from developing countries to developed. Yes, indeed. At the aggregate level, if you look developing country as a whole, each year currently, developing country provide a net of about $800 billion U.S. dollars as capital outflow, net flow to developed. But if you look at Africa and also RDC, these two groups indeed receive net inflows from the rest of the world. But of course, not necessarily from all developed countries, some also from middle-income developing countries. For example, for RDC, they receive FDI only about $20 billion a year, but they receive $40 billion ODA, according to latest data. So ODA is still very important for RDC.
Escape from the conditionalities imposed by the IMF. Do you think arrangements like this would be a way out of this trap?
You mean the BRICS Bank?
Yeah.
These are early days, let me say that first. I think as officials who work on development, we can nothing but welcome a new player on the development arena, and with the might of the five emerging countries, the governance arrangements are interesting, peculiar. Jury is very much out there as to how this new bank will deal with social and environmental safeguards. Not us saying it, President of the World Bank has very notably expressed his remarks on that front. I think it is a cautious welcome, and let's wait and see.
Thank you.
Sure. Thanks a lot. Matthew Lee, Intercity Press, on behalf of the Free UN Coalition for Access. Thanks for the briefing. I wanted to ask actually about the IMF kind of overall. If they're said to be part of the UN system or family in some way, and I wanted to know what's their role under this. Goal 8 and sustainability, and in particular, in your response to the first question about where you mentioned these HIPC countries, you know, Eritrea, pre-decisional, Eritrea, Somalia, and Sudan, and seem to say that the only reason they're not going forward is for absence of a plan. It seems like, I mean, countries speak openly about actually blocking debt relief, for example, to Sudan, you know, for political reasons or based on their own internal national dialogue with opponents. Like, it doesn't seem to be entirely just an economic issue. I'd say probably the same thing was true of Eritrea, which is under sanctions. So I wanted to know, you know, in candor, what is the blockages to debt relief to these countries, for example, purely economic and planning, or are they political? And what's the role in this week and just more generally of these high-sounding goals and the IMF as an actual, you know, lender and player in the system? Thanks.
Thank you. Mr. Kass.
I mean, the IMF clearly has a role, is a very important role of the architecture of delivering on the MDGs and on the SDGs. It is clear to any reader that these four countries that Mr. Hong mentioned and that you just repeated, they don't only have economic challenges. They are countries in conflict or emerging from conflict, and in these and you need a minimum of administrative capacity and of institutional capacity in place and a certain stability in order to be able to really go into a HIPIC process. I don't think that the IMF is trying to stay out of its responsibilities in regard to the delivery on the MDGs or in the future on the SDGs. I think that is very, and you will see next week probably their presence quite strongly here as well. They are part of the monitoring also of the MDG 8, I think going forward with the SDGs, they will certainly be involved. We have to make sure that they are on board.
Thank you.
Do you want to?
Hello, my name is Matthew Carpenter. I'm a reporter for Yomiuri Shimbun, a Japanese newspaper. Now, there's been talk about working with the developing world with their sovereign debt, but the developed world also struggles with debt problems. Do you consider the debt problems that the developed world struggle with a threat to the UN development agenda, and if so, how much so?
I mean, it's definitely an important factor that has to be dealt with, and if you look at the figures of the development cooperation of the ODA over the past years, I mean, in 2013 it picked up again, but we had a slowing down during the two previous years, and that undoubtedly was linked to the financial crisis in the developed world as well. The capacity of member states and of traditional donors to put aside funds for development cooperation, but also the readiness of the population and the citizens and the taxpayers in those countries to support an altruistic, if I can say, or a solidarity perspective in foreign policy generally, is strongly influenced by the debt situation in each of the countries.
Yes, please.
Good morning. My name is Phan Tuấn Anh. I'm reporting for Zhenqi Online News from Vietnam. In light of the current situation of in different parts of the world, which are witnessing increasing levels of tension and conflicts and crises, ranging from the Ebola crisis to the Ukraine crisis and tension in the Middle East and the IS. How do you think these events will affect countries in trying to achieve their Millennium Development Goals as well as the post-2015 goals?
Conflict and the consequences of conflict inflict the heaviest loss to development gains, just like destruction produced by high vulnerability to hydrometeorological events and lack of preparedness for extreme climatic events produces the loss of the development gains that have been accumulated for decades, for a generation perhaps. So we are extremely concerned about this increase in conflicts, insofar we know that first they represent a destruction of development conquests. Second, they will leave scorched land behind and reconstruction will have to ensue. Third, reconstruction will be expensive and therefore efforts will have to be directed towards coming back from minus zero to a situation where, fourth, we will have to restart again the development effort. So the concerted effort of the international community and the countries in conflict is precisely to establish the conditions for the ceasing of those conflicts as soon as possible and entering into the recovery phase. We have seen how inevitably, year after year, the lowest countries in the Human Development Index are the countries who either are in conflict or come back from a conflict. The list that Mr. Pingfang just mentioned of countries that are not in a condition of restructuring their debt are all countries that have been affected by conflict. So I think it is pretty obvious that there is a very direct link between the development work and the conflict prevention and recovery work.
If I may just to add to that, the natural disasters, which is a different issue, but also just as important and sets us back. Yep. And yet, natural disasters are part of life. And therefore, they have to be a reason for the international society, the international community, to strengthen its resilience and to help vulnerable states strengthen their resilience. And this is an important aspect of the post-2015 agenda going forward. At the same time, when disasters happen, there are moments where of solidarity also, where populations in non-affected countries can realize, you know, it could happen to us, and that sense of a common humanity is sometimes strengthened, and many times is strengthened during these very unfortunate events.
Mr. Horn?
Yeah, just to add technical points there. If you read our sister report, means the MDG report, this is the MDG gap report, from that one previously released in July, you will see over there not a single conflict-affected country so far has achieved any single MDG. So conflict and violence are very important factors to impede MDG progress. And second, in this report, from the ODA allocation, probably you can say, which is the country received the most ODA? Afghanistan. So actually, it's, the resources has been kind of allocated to conflict countries. In that sense, reduce probably international resources, you know, to actually the countries to support other countries in their MDG achievement.
Thank you. Okay. Yes, last question, please.
Thank you. My name is Go Kamoshida from NHK, the Japanese public broadcaster. As you know, among the MDGs, goal number one, which is to halve the population under the extreme poverty, is met globally. But as you know, there is a huge regional gap. And I think that most of African countries, sub-Saharan African countries, are far behind the target. So could you give us what could be the key to overcome this regional gap from the donor's point of view? Thank you.
Let me try to answer your question with something that is highly interesting in the discussions, both of the Secretary General's high level panel and of the Open Working Group. There was a strong awareness that measuring general averages doesn't cut it anymore. It's not enough to say that at the aggregate level in the world, or at the aggregate level in China, or at the aggregate level in Brazil, we have attained X percent of reduction of poverty. We need to have a finer needle, be more granular in that analysis. We need to know in which states, in which regions, amongst which populations. Is it the coastal communities? Is it the men or the women? Is it the young people? Because statistics and information are basically meant to be useful for public policy making. So you need that information if you want to address the issues with good public policy. And that's where your question points at a very important element. We need a little bit more segmentation so that when we are looking at global gaps, we can then look at where the achievements have happened and where there is still an effort to be made. We know that the contribution of China and India to the achievement of the MDG-1 has been enormous. What does that tell us about other countries or other regions, as you mentioned? Africa is a more nuanced panorama and scenario than the one you established, I think. I would want to indicate that some of the prosperous nations in Africa that are in a growth belt have achieved very significant benchmarks in terms of poverty reduction and almost some of them even eradication of extreme poverty. You start having examples of African economic miracles where good, sound public policies, usually combined with extractive resources or the discovery of extractive riches, have arrived at a good result. So, indeed, we need to be a little bit more nuanced and looking at where the poverty reduction really is achieved and what is the flip side of that coin where public policies still have to target specific populations.
Okay, we will have to draw this press conference to a close. I would like to thank our guests very much for joining us today and thank all of you for coming. Have a good afternoon.